Okay, everyone, so now we can continue where we left off yesterday. We're coming now to the very end of dependent origination. We have been looking at all the factors all the way up to the very end. And if you remember, at the very end of this sequence, it says that, and this is the origination of this whole mass of suffering here. Right? So what is this mass of suffering? And of course, this mass of suffering is the fact that when you get reborn and then you die, this is a thing that continues indefinitely into the future. And this is the problem. It just keeps on going, keeps on, keeps on going. And there are some very nice suttas in the, I think it's called the Anamataka Sanyutta, where it talks about precisely this kind of thing, this kind of endlessness of samsara, the fact that it goes on and on. And these suttas very nicely kind of bring together the problem that this fact is. The fact of continuous rebirth, it comes out very nicely in this particular sutta. And this is one of the suttas from there. And it shows you what the problems actually are. And this sutta is called Tears. And this is how it goes. Atsavati, because this samsara is without discoverable beginning. The first point is not discerned of beings roaming and wandering on, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. What do you think, bhikkhus? Which is more, the stream of tears that you have shed as you roamed and wander on through this long course, weeping and wailing because of being united with the disagreeable and separated from the agreeable, this or the water in the four great oceans? As we understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, the stream of tears that we have shed as we roamed and wandered through this long course, weeping and wailing because of being united with the disagreeable and separated from the agreeable, this alone is more than the water of the four great oceans. So this is like a bleak picture of existence, right? It's not very, it's kind of sets that if you are not used to the Buddhist teaching, Buddhist ideas, you think, gee, this is really bleak. This is terrible. But of course, the point is that the Buddha is here to tell us the way that he sees things, the way that he has discovered reality. Sometimes it's important to get that information to be motivated in the right way, to do what is appropriate to escape that predicament. If you don't know reality, if you don't see things as they actually are, you have no possibility of making rational decisions. Rational decisions come from having a basis in fact, a basis in what reality actually is like. So this may look bleak, but perhaps it's true, right? And if it's true, it has very important consequences. The Buddha says that people are motivated by different things, and this, of course, is being motivated by suffering, by the difficulties and negative things in life. Other people are motivated by seeing the good aspects, right? Seeing the happiness of the path, the good things that you're moving on towards, and all of that. And some people are motivated by a mixture of both, a mixture of understanding the dangers, the dukkha, and also by the potential happiness. So this is actually a sutta about that. There's a sutta pretty much about everything, and there's a sutta about that as well. And I think a lot of people are motivated by this mixture, right? This seeing the danger. If to really be motivated to get out of samsara, you have to understand that there is a problem. If it is all just about happiness, then you may wonder, there is perhaps no need to escape, right? I think most people find this mixture, understanding the danger, but also understanding all the beauty, all those wonderful experiences you can have through meditation practice. When those two things kind of come together, I think it gives you a powerful motive to keep get on with your practice and do what is appropriate and right. So not kind of wallow too much in the suffering, because then it just makes you depressed and sad. But at the same time, just remember that, and also remember all the beautiful aspects of the Buddhist path. And then you can kind of find a nice balance in how to look at this. So this then is just an explanation really for this whole mass of suffering, what that actually means. And then the Buddha replies, good, good, bhikkhus, it is good that you understand the Dhamma taught by me in such a way. The stream of tears that you have shed as you roamed and wandered through this long course, weeping and wailing because of being united with the disagreeable and separated from the agreeable. This alone is more than the water in the four great oceans. For a long time, bhikkhus, you have experienced the death of a mother, as you have experienced this weeping and wailing because of being united with the disagreeable and separated from the agreeable. The streams of tears that you have shed is more than the water in the four great oceans. For a long time, bhikkhus, you have experienced the death of a father, the death of a brother, the death of a sister, the death of a son, the death of a daughter, the loss of relatives, the loss of wealth, loss through illness. As you have experienced this weeping and wailing because of being united with the disagreeable and separated from the agreeable, the stream of tears that you have shed is more than the water in the four great oceans. So this is the here. What is also noticeable about this is this gives you the meaning of united with the disagreeable and separated from the agreeable. You may remember that from the first noble truth, right? It says there, except being united with the disagreeable, etc. That is, this is suffering, and this gives you the main idea of what that is about, or at least the most powerful impact of that particular expression here. Death of loved ones, basically, here. And then the Buddha says, for what reason? Because this samsara is without discoverable beginning. The first point is not discerned of beings roaming and wandering on, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. It is enough to experience revulsion towards all phenomena, enough to become dispassionate towards them, enough to be liberated from them. So once you see this, once you understand the beginningless thing, it's like the Buddha, when the Buddha understood, recollected his past life, he started to get a feeling for this, right? Seeing what is actually going on. And it says, this is enough to experience revulsion towards all formations. Sabbe sankhara is the expression here. Sabbe sankhara, revulsion towards all these things. This little expression here, experiencing revulsion towards all formations, or sabbe sankhara, this is kind of an important to understand what this is referring to. We were looking, as you remember, on the very first day, we were talking about the gradual experience of meditation practice, going from pamuja, gladness, all the way to samadhi, and then to yathabhuta nanadasana. I'm sure you remember that. And after the yathabhuta nanadasana, what comes after that is nibbida, which is the same word that is here explained as, translated as revulsion. Right? So nibbida is one of those very important things on the Buddhist path that eventually you have to experience towards here all formations. Right? All phenomena, essentially. So what exactly does this mean? It's important to get a little bit of a handle on this. And the first thing to notice about this is the word sankhara is used here again. Here it is translated as formations. I just translated as phenomena. Basically, sankhara in this context means everything that has come into existence through causes, anything which has been created, right? Sankhara actually means put together. It means that which has been created or that which creates. And this duality of meaning in sankhara is very important to understand, that on the one hand, it means all those things that actually create things. These are the active sankhara, the sankhara as you see in dependent arising. Dependent arising, it means the creation of a future. You're creating a new life, creating new existence. In fact, you're creating more khandhas, if you like, for the future. This is the active part of sankhara, the putting together, right, where it is equivalent roughly to chaitana, which is the volition of the mind. We will things, we project ourselves into the future, we crave, and all of these kind of things. But sankhara also has this other side, which is the actual phenomena that we create. Of course, the phenomena we create, again, are just the five khandhas, right? But the five khandhas are, here the five khandhas are seen as this process which goes on in sankhara, carries on, and there's a lot of suffering involved in that process. So here it is seen as the results. But it's important to understand the distinction, that distinction between the two usages of sankhara, because the meaning will be different depending on the context. And in this context, it means all phenomena in the context of dependent arising, and the five aggregates, it means the volition, the will, the creative activity. So just please keep that in mind. And then we have this word revulsion, nibbida. How should that be understood? Sometimes when people hear that, they feel revulsion. Wow, that sounds like, you know, getting angry or getting aversion or getting really upset about things. What is that? Can that possibly be wholesome? Surely revulsion sounds like an unwholesome state. And it is tricky to translate these words in such a way as to give the right meaning. Now, in his latest translation of the Anguttara Nikaya, Bhikkhu Bodhi has gone back to an earlier translation, which is this disenchantment that he uses there. And some people think disenchantment is better because it has less of this powerful emotional impact. It sounds like you're becoming angry almost when you're talking about revulsion. But of course, the final say for the meaning of these words, it actually has to be the suttas themselves. How do the suttas describe this word? And one very good way of doing that is to look at how these words are used in many contexts. One of the contexts for nibbida is where it describes the feeling you have when you have like a sore. You have a sore on your arm or something like that. And there's all this pus coming out, right? All these kind of disgusting things coming out of the sore. It's not very nice. So that is called nibbida. The feeling you have towards all that pus and those sores is called nibbida. It's not disenchantment. You're not disenchanted with it. You feel repelled by it. It's revolting. It's not nice. You try to get rid of that pus. You use medicine or whatever because it's not nice. So I feel in many ways that the translation, which has to be stronger than disenchantment to do full justice to a word like nibbida. It means quite a powerful emotional reaction in one way or another. And the reason why Bhikkhu Bodhi changed his translation, because the reason why he chose to use revulsion in the first place was because of feedback he got from others. And then once he had done that, you know, he lives in the United States, and this is where the majority of these books get published and bought. And ordinary people who, you know, who are Buddhist, and they're often very new to Buddhism. You know, this is America. They come from a Christian or Jewish background or something like that. And they said, this is terrible. This is word revulsion. It turns me off reading the suttas. And because of that, he decided, okay, I'll change it back to something more neutral. But it's dangerous. Once you do that sort of thing, there's a tendency, a danger of watering down the Dhamma, watering down the real message. In the short term, it might make more people read the suttas, but in the long term, you might not get the real message of the Dhamma across. And this, of course, to me, is by far the most important thing, because you want to encourage people to practice this path to the very end. So what does it mean? I argued with him. I wrote to him and said, you know, revulsion, that's what it means. Look at these passages. And he told me about the feedback that he had received from other people. Anyway, so what does it actually mean? What does it mean to be revolted or repelled? I think repulsion is also a nice translation for this. What does it actually mean? What it means, one way of understanding this is a bit like, imagine yourself, you are in your house, and there is by accident you put your hand on a hot plate. Usually the hot plate hasn't been used, so it's fine, you can put your hand there, no problem. But on this particular day, the hot plate had just been used, right? So you put your hand there, and as soon as you put your hand there, it is so hot. So what do you do? Do you think, oh, should I remove my hand or not? You know, is this going to hurt if I keep it there? You don't. What happens is there's an automatic reaction straight away. The hand just withdraws, right? And it's not because you are disenchanted with the hot plate. You're not disenchanted with it. It's more like you have a sense of aversion towards the pain, a sense of repulsion. That's why you are literally repelled. Your arm gets withdrawn automatically. You don't need to think about it. This just happens as a matter of course. And this is exactly what happens in the context of samsara. once you understand dukkha, once you see what is actually going on, the mind repels, it withdraws by itself. It can't bear it anymore. It's just too much suffering. You don't have to say to your mind, oh, time to withdraw, this is suffering. It's an automatic reaction. And this is why repulsion, I think, is a nice idea, because you literally are repelled from it. You're drawn away. It's like two poles of the magnet, right? The same pole meeting another one. It just repels. This is exactly the same kind of thing. You just, whoa, withdrawn from that. You can't bear it any longer. It's a strong emotional reaction. It's got nothing to do with defilements, nothing to do with anger, nothing to do with negativity. But it's this sense of just having enough of the suffering and withdrawing from it. That is the right way to understand this word. Once you understand the word, it actually becomes quite meaningful, and you can see what is going on here. So it's this unbearability of samsara, the withdrawing from something which is just too much to bear, and you're going in a different direction. So that is the word nibbana. And of course, once you see this fully, once you withdraw in a sense, these are very profound things, right? These are things you're talking now about, insight, very high insights. When you see the world as it actually is, it leaves these powerful emotional reactions in you. We're coming here towards the very end of the path in many ways, towards at least attaining stream entry. This is moving towards that very fast. And of course, once you see that, it's enough to become dispassionate. This is viraga. Viraga is losing your interest in these things, right? The dispassion. So losing interest means that craving is dying down. Craving is starting to disappear. You're becoming dispassionate towards all phenomena, right? Everything, absolutely everything, all rebirth, all existence. You had enough of that because you have seen what rebirth, what existence actually is all about. And then when the craving fades away, eventually when the craving disappears completely, that is what is called here liberation. Liberation means craving having disappeared altogether. So that is the idea of the sutta. What is interesting here is that you, when you see the problems of samsara, you're not just repelled by those particular problems, by those particular existences that cause those problems, right? Perhaps the human existence and the lower realms, perhaps. No, you are repelled from absolutely everything, because you understand that once you are in this cycle of rebirth, it doesn't matter if you stay in the jhana realms for a while, right? You hang out there for a few eons, okay? It's very nice, right? You feel very happy and blissed out. But when that comes to an end, you have to come back down again. It doesn't matter if you stay there for a while. Once you come to the end, that is going to be the present moment. Then you have to accept the consequences of that, and then you come back down again. So you see the connection between all of these things, and the whole lot you want to throw it out. Everything you want to dismiss, all sankharas, every phenomena, regardless of how refined it is, has to go. This is the only way to find the liberation from these things. Okay. So there you are. That is the sutta on tears, right? And there's a lot of other suttas. I don't know if you like this kind of suttas or whether you find them a little bit too much or whatever. But if you enjoy this kind of suttas, there is many more where they come from. If you go to the Annamattagga Sanghita, I think it's called, there is very similar things about the mountain of bones that you have heaped up as you travel through samsara, the amount of blood you have shed by traveling through samsara, etc., etc. Very graphic, very powerful, strong statements about the problem. The Buddha is really driving home the message that there is an issue here, there is a problem here. It is not something just to kind of to bypass and forget about. Okay, so that is really the end of dependent origination. What I want to do now is to have a look at a sutta which looks at dependent origination a little bit more from a kind of practical perspective. What does this actually look like in real life? So far, quite perhaps theoretical in some ways. I think many practical points that we have touched on the way, but at the same time, perhaps a little bit theoretical. This next sutta shows us how, to some extent, how this happens in practice, how actually this is experienced by a person. And this is the Mahatana Sankhya Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 38, a very important sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya that describes dependent origination in great detail. And then it ends off with a practical example of how this actually works. So now I'm going to focus just on that practical example and just get a little bit of feeling for, you know, how this actually works out. So this is a small extract from a very long sutta that I've taken out here. Because the descent of the embryo takes place through the union of three things. Here there is the union of mother and father, but the mother is not in season and the Gandhava is not present. In this case, no descent of an embryo takes place. Here there is the union of mother and father, and the mother is in season, but the Gandhava is not present. In this case too, no descent of the embryo takes place. But when there is union of mother and father, and the mother is in season, and the Gandhava is present, through the union of these three things, the descent of the embryo takes place. So this is the beginning, right? And you will recognize straight away that this obviously has to do with birth, has to do with the beginning of a life, obviously. And of course, one of the interesting things here again is that you can see that this is there is like the Gandhava, right? The Gandhava is kind of present, which is obviously the life that is ready to get reborn, is there. So you can see once more how this has to do with the movement from one life to another one. It is all about moving from life to life, the samsaric process repeating itself. These practical examples, I think, are very clear that dependent origination has all to do with rebirth. Rebirth is one of those fundamental aspects of dependent origination. And so that is one thing which is very interesting. There's a few things which are very interesting here. The other thing which is interesting, of course, is the idea that here we have some idea of what conception is all about according to the Buddhist teachings. When, you know, one of the kind of, I think, important ethical dilemmas and ethical questions that we often talk about from a Buddhist point of view is things like abortion. Is abortion, is that, what is it? Is it bad? If it is bad, how bad is it? Is it like, is there, what are the limits on these things? And from a Buddhist point of view, actually it's quite a complicated issue, how bad abortion is and whether it is bad, at what point it is bad, etc. And this is one of those few places that actually gives us some idea of the Buddhist attitude towards this. So one of the things is that when you read this, it might look like the moment that conception takes place, the Gandhava is already there. This could be one reading of this passage, right? Only conception can only really happen when there is a Gandhava, when there is a consciousness that enters into that being, that renewed being. But I think that may be probably reading too much into this. And the reason is simply that this idea of union, sannipata, of things coming together, doesn't necessarily, it is difficult to know exactly what it means. It doesn't necessarily mean at the same moment. It means that at some stage these three things have to come together, but I think it can be understood as there being some temporal, some time difference between them, but eventually they have to come together. It is difficult to know exactly from this the precise meaning of this. So I would say to understand this to mean that the consciousness is there from the very beginning, from the very start of conception itself, I think might be reading too much into this passage. There is an interesting passage in another sutta. This is the Asalayana Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya number 93, which talks about exactly the same thing. It talks about the when conception takes place. And from that sutta, what is interesting is that it becomes clear that this point of view, this understanding of what happens, is actually a Brahmanical point of view. Right, the Brahmins of old, they also had this idea, mother and father, mother is in the right season, and there's a Gandhava present. This seems to have been an ancient understanding of what happens at conception, how a being comes into existence. So it looks like that, it looks from that, that this basically is a Brahmanical teaching that came from the ancient Indian culture and is not necessarily a Buddhist one. So the reason why the Buddha is using that here is probably because he thought that that is close enough, or it is good enough for Buddhist purposes to use that idea, and he used that idea here to explain the arising of a being in a new birth. That is interesting because it means that it is not perhaps a very precise or very clearly defined thing. In fact, the Buddha may have used it because it's good enough without giving it a very precise Buddhist definition or whatever. So this is the first thing about this. And the other thing which, of course, is interesting, and I think always this is also important and useful to help us with our understanding also of Buddhist texts, and that is some of the anecdotal evidence you sometimes hear. You hear evidence, people talking about these things, and there is a sort of evidence you sometimes hear is that, you know, a mother who can kind of feel the being arising in her womb. You actually, she sometimes there is like a connection with a being which is about to be reborn. And sometimes she has a vision of somebody entering the womb, right? And then that becomes kind of the beginning of that life. And often these anecdotal evidences, they are not, of course, 100% reliable. Sometimes they are uncertain. But there may be some truth. Often there is a lot of truth to these anecdotal evidences. And what happens there is that this entry of the being into the womb, it seems, often can take place much later in the pregnancy than at the time of conception. This is one kind of evidence you hear about. Another one is the evidence of kind of the beings themselves who remember the process from one life and then going into rebirth, right? And then entering the womb somewhere. And that too often has a feeling of not happening necessarily at conception, but sometimes happening much later than that. So this idea of rebirth, when it happens, at what time a consciousness arises in the womb, at what time there is a being there that can feel anything, is a very complicated issue. And I'm not sure if there is any final answer to when that actually happens. And in the end, it's probably going to have to be a scientific thing to find out at what time that happens. So this is that makes it difficult. And of course, another interesting thing about this whole idea of the ethics and the karma incurred, you know, with abortion and all of these kind of things, is also, well, what is the karmic consequences of, you know, even if there is a being there, say that there is a vijnana or a mind already established in that embryo, what are the karmic consequences of killing a small embryo like that compared to killing a human being? And of course, generally speaking, in Buddhism, if you kill something very small and very simple, which is not very developed, generally speaking, the karmic consequences are less than if you kill something which is very mature, which has very strong attachment to life, right? Which has an ability to make a difference in the world, which already has a lot of social connections, etc. And one way of understanding this, which I think is a very nice way of looking at the idea of conception and how a being arises in the womb. One of the similes used by the Buddha for the arising and passing away of beings, the Chut Upapatanyana, is the idea of moving from house to house. This is the simile used in the suttas, right? Now, if you think of yourself moving from house to house, this is like dying and being reborn. You're moving from one house, moving to another one. This is the simile used. Now, when you move from one house to another house, usually it's a gradual process, right? You kind of sign the contract to buy the house. Gradually the house kind of feels more like home. It becomes yours. And then you move in your furniture. And gradually the attachment to the new place, to the new house, grows. And I think the process of rebirth is probably very similar to that, right? You move into this new life. Initially, you have very little attachment to that tiny embryo. There's hardly anything there. And as this embryo develops and the body becomes more mature, the nama, all the perceptions and feelings become more mature, etc., you start to feel at home, so to speak, in that embryo, later on as a child, later on as an adult. And there's a gradual moving into that experience, just as you're moving into a new house. Your attachment grows, and your feeling of belonging there kind of grows as well. So again, this kind of says something about the karma that is involved. So I don't think the karma is the same all the way across. It may be bad karma all the way through, but the degree of bad karma, I think, is very, very varied, depending on when an abortion is taken, etc., etc. Anyway, these are very difficult issues, and very complicated, and very hard to come to any final conclusion about. But these are just some of my thoughts and ideas about that. And then, again, there is this idea of the Gandhaba being present, right? And again, this points again to the things we talked about the other day, about the Antarabhava, the Gandhaba who is there, kind of waiting to be reborn, so to speak. And again, if you look at the other sutta I was just talking about, the Asalayana Sutta, there they question these Brahmins, and they ask these Brahmins, well, this Gandhava that is there, is that a Brahmin? Is it a Kshatriya? Is it a, you know, what kind of caste is this Brahmin belong to her? This Gandhava belong to her? And they say, we don't know what caste it is. Because remember, the Brahmins, they're all about the purity of the Brahmanical lineage, right? So when you get reborn, you have to be pure 7 generations back or whatever. This is the way it is explained in the suttas. But they don't actually know whether that Gandhava is a Brahmin or not. And the point, of course, is that the Buddha is trying to kind of, you know, show these Brahmins that this idea of Brahmanical purity doesn't make any sense in reality here. Because the body is just the body. The real thing which comes into place here is the mind. And you have no idea where that mind comes from. But the interesting thing is that they talk about that mind as if it has already a certain quality to it. It belongs to a certain caste, right? So we're obviously talking about a past life. We're talking about a movement from one life to another one. You can see that the Gandhava is this entity moving from one existence to another. So that is becomes very clear from that particular sutta. And Gandhava, this word also exists in Sanskrit. Gandharva is the word there. It's a very interesting creature, these Gandhavas. One thing is the fact that they seem to be these beings in the intermediate existence. But another interesting thing is about the Gandhavas, they're also a type of rebirth, right? You can be reborn as a Gandhava. So considered quite a bad kind of, not a very good rebirth, it's kind of the very lower heavenly realms. It's better than being reborn as a human, but it's kind of not very good, right? It's kind of fine, good enough if you want to play around and you want to have a good time. They're sometimes called the heavenly musicians, these Gandhavas. One of the stories of the Gandhava, this is from the Sakapanya Sutta. The Sakapanya Sutta is a very interesting sutta. It has a lot of nice Dhamma in it, but it also has some really outrageous stories, right? And outrageous stories are always good fun, because sometimes they are very interesting precisely because they are so different, and you wonder what is going on. But one of the stories there, which is very nice, is the story of this woman who has been reborn into the heavenly realm, in the Tavatinsa realm, which Tavatinsa realm is like where the Sakka is the chief, right, the second heavenly realm up in the Kama Loka. And she has been reborn in the Tavatinsa. But before she got reborn there, she was a laywoman in the world, and she was a lay Buddhist, and she was supporting all these monks, right? She was giving food to them. And then one day, after she has been reborn in the heavenly realm, Tavatinsa, she sees these monks that she was supporting, and they have been reborn as Gandhavas. So Gandhavas, she is up here, and the Gandhavas are kind of down there. The Gandhavas are like the servants of the Tavatinsa Devas. And she goes down to those monks, and she scolds them. He says, "You monks, I fed you for all this time. What were you doing? You weren't practicing properly. I have been reborn as a superior deva. You are down there as heavenly musicians, messing around, just enjoying sensual pleasures. Didn't you practice? Didn't you listen to the teachings?" And she really scolds them. And This is how things were in those days. Lay people sometimes would really scold the monks, right? And then those monks, a couple of those monks, they regain mindfulness. They remember the Buddha's teachings, and because they regain mindfulness and they kind of remember what was going on, they give up those sense pleasures and they get reborn in the Brahma Loka, in the kind of the jhana realms instead. Two of them didn't have, the third one, he just stayed there as a Gandhava. He couldn't get rid of those sensual pleasures. So it's a nice little story about what happens. And it shows you that the Gandhavas were considered fairly lowly, right? They were indulging in sensual pleasures. There was nothing very lofty about them. And so in this same sutta, that was one of the stories that was told by Sakka, I think, after he met the Buddha. In this same sutta, the Sakkapanya Sutta, one of the really strange things that happens in this sutta, Sakka, the Lord of the Tavatinsa heaven, decides, I want to see the Buddha. I want to learn something about the Dhamma. Right? And he is a bit shy about this. It's very sweet, right? This is the Lord of the Tavatinsa heaven. He is shy about visiting the Buddha. The idea here is you see the hierarchy. What really matters is wisdom and insight, not just being the Lord of some fabulous heavenly realm. So he's shy about that. So he goes to, what's his name? Panchasika, that's right, thank you. Panchasika is his name. Panchasika is the Gandhava. And he goes to Panchasika and he says, well, why don't you go down and get the attention from the Buddha? And once you have the attention, then I will feel comfortable going down and speaking to the Buddha. So he sends this heavenly musician down to get the attention of the Buddha. So this heavenly musician, he comes down to the Buddha. The Buddha is staying in this cave. So he starts playing this song to get the Buddha's attention. And the song that he's playing to the Buddha is a love song, right? It's true. It is astonishing. It's like you couldn't make up anything more strange. And the love song goes like, oh, you know, just like I love this wonderful young girl in the same way that the arahants love the Dhamma. This is the song. You can read it for yourself. It's right there, black on white. It's one of those weird things. But it's so strange that you wonder, maybe this happened, right? Maybe this, because this is kind of the human realm. Strange things happen. And when you see strange things like that, sometimes you think, maybe it is real. Nobody would make this kind of thing up. It is almost like being disrespectful to the Buddha, right? Nobody could make that up. It could only be put in there if it was real. It's almost like sacrilege. It's kind of the Buddhist equivalent to blasphemy almost, you know, this kind of thing. So anyway, I'm just saying this just as a kind of nice little story. This is what the Gandhavas were like, right? Full of desires and all this kind of things. So this is one aspect of the Gandhavas. These are the two meanings of the Gandhavas in the suttas. Heavenly musicians and also the spirit in the Antrabhava waiting to be reborn. So anyway, just a bit of amusement there before we get back to the serious business again here. So, that is what happens. So this is how the conception takes place when these three things come together. What happens next? What happens next is this. The mother then carries the embryo in her womb for 9 or 10 months with much anxiety as a heavy burden. Then at the end of 9 or 10 months, the mother gives birth with much anxiety and as a heavy burden. Then when the child is born, she nourishes it with her own blood, for the mother's breast milk is called blood in the noble one's discipline. So here we just have the idea of the child maturing, it takes 9 or 10 months. The lunar months are shorter than the solar months. That's probably why it is 9 or 10 rather than the normal 9. And interesting here how the Buddha talks about with much anxiety and as a heavy burden. And again, I think the idea perhaps why he says that is that a lot of the time, you know, you think about, oh yeah, you know, a child is such a wonderful thing. But there's also a downside to that, right? There's a downside to becoming pregnant and all of these things. There is a certain anxiety and burden with that as well. Again, this idea that the mother's breast milk is called blood. I'm not sure exactly what that means, but I think the idea is it is a sacrifice to become a mother, right? It is not that you have to sacrifice yourself to a large extent. And of course, the sacrifice only begins then, and then it continues for a long time afterwards. Once you become a parent, there's a lot of sacrifice just in looking after a child for years and years and decades sometimes. So this is all part and parcel of the same thing here. Anyway, let's just continue. When he grows up and his faculties mature, the child plays such games as toy plows, tipcat, somersaults, toy windmills, toy measures, toy cars, and toy bow and arrow. Right? So you can see that the way children played hasn't changed all that much in 2,500 years. They still play with toy cars and with this kind of stuff. Still do somersaults? I hope so. Anyway, I hope they haven't not just playing computer games these days. I hope they still do some of these things. So you can, and of course, what we are starting to see here is also, you know, part of the other aspects of dependent origination. You know, when you grow up like this, you become a child and you play with these things, because you enjoy that, right? Your feelings are satisfied, you crave for these things, and because of that you have the upadana, the attachment to all these little toys, right? Don't take my toy car, that is my toy car, that is yours over there, you go away. And you have attachment to those toy cars, you live in the world of toy cars, and you make kamma accordingly, even when you are a small child. And then things get more serious as you get older. When he grows up and his faculties mature still further, the youth enjoys himself, provided and endowed with the 5 kinds of sense objects. The forms cognizable by the eye, sounds cognizable by the ear, odors cognizable by the nose, flavors cognizable by the tongue, tangibles cognizable by the body, that are wished for, desired, agreeable, likable, connected with sensual desire, and provocative of lust or desire, if you like. So these are the 5 cores of sensual pleasure, the sensual objects in the world. And this is kama, of course. This is what kama is all about. Kama gunas is what they're called here, 5 cores. So because you are enjoying yourself in this way, this is what happens next. And this is where you kind of see the practical example, if you like, of dependent origination happening here. On seeing a form with the eye, he lusts after it if it is pleasing, and he dislikes it if it is unpleasing or displeasing. He abides with mindfulness of the body unestablished, with a limited mind, and he does not understand, as it actually is, the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom, wherein those bad, unwholesome qualities cease without remainder. So this is the basic predicament of the ordinary person, right? This is how ordinary people, the less they know about the Dhamma, the more engulfed and completely submersed they are in this kind of world, the ordinary people who just enjoy sensuality. So you desire, it's very obvious, you can see here the links of dependent origination, right? You see a form with the eye, the salayatana gives rise to contact, that's the seeing the form with the eye, and then that form is either pleasing or displeasing, this is a vedana, and then you lust, or you desire it, or you dislike it, this is tanha, right? You can see all the aspects of dependent arising right there, how it kind of plays out in reality. And one of the things here to remember is that an object, it says here, if it is pleasing or displeasing, then that is what decides whether you like it or dislike it. But remember that whether an object is pleasing or displeasing is not inherent in the object itself. If these things were inherent in the object, then as soon as you have a certain contact, there's nothing you can do about it. You will experience pain, displeasure, or pleasure as a consequence. because it is not inherent in the object, it means that we can manipulate these things. Depending on how you perceive it, how you look at it, an unpleasant object can become pleasant. A pleasant object can become unpleasant. And this is what I was talking about before, about passa, contact. Contact means two things. It means the physical contact with the physical body, the patiga sampasa, right? And it also means the mental contact, the way we actually relate to that object, the adivachana sampasa, the designation contact. And both of those are important. So there is no inherent things in the world, either things are unpleasant or pleasant. You can play with these things, you can move them around. In fact, it says in the suttas that the arahant has perfect control over this thing, right? He can see an unpleasant object as pleasant, something pleasant as unpleasant. This is found in the Indriya Bhavana Sutta, the last sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, how the arahant can choose his perception almost at will, his or her perception almost at will. And of course, this gives us the way out, right? This is where sense restraint becomes possible. This is where using wisdom to understand things in the right way becomes possible, because it's not inherent in the object. It rather has to do with how we perceive things, how we use the perceptual process, how the vipalasas, how the papancha sanya sankha, right, of the Madhupindika Sutta, how that process works. And if we eliminate some of that papancha, if we see through it and we start to see things clearly, then we can deal with this situation and look at it differently. And we're no longer so trapped by it. We don't dislike and like things so much, and we don't even see the objects quite in the same way anymore. And the reason why this person has that problem is because he abides with mindfulness of the body unestablished. So the idea here, mindfulness of the body can mean many different things. If you can have a look at the Kayagata Sati Sutta, if you like, which is the Majjhima Nikaya 119. It gives you various ways of thinking about the mindfulness of the body. But the main idea here with mindfulness of the body is the fact that you have present moment awareness, right? You are with the present moment. You are here. You know what is going on. And because you know what is going on, you have an ability to react to these things in the right way. You no longer allow yourself to be submerged by desires and aversion, but you actually react to things in a way which leads you out of the problem. So that is the main, I think, to me, that is the main message here. When you have this mindfulness of the body, it means you are in the present moment, and you can use the Indriya Sangvara Sila, the restraint of the senses, to actually act in an appropriate way. And he has a limited mind, right? This, when you are disliking and you are liking things, your mind is limited. Your mind is constrained. Your mind is not expansive. And you can almost feel what that means just by feeling what your mind feels like. When you go more towards samadhi and when you are more engulfed in the world of sensuality. Right? The mind is limited. Our ordinary state of mind is where we think of things as mine and yours, me and you, right? Enemy and friend, this attractive person, unattractive person. We're creating all these barriers in the world between us and others, between objects we own, objects we don't own. And all these barriers create limitations. They create things that stop us from having this metta and universal kindness and all of these kind of things. So that is why this is called the limited mind. And it's exactly the opposite of the unlimited mind. The unlimited mind is the apamana citta, the citta, the mind that you develop when you develop the Brahma Viharas in particular. And of course, one of the aspects of the Brahma Viharas is precisely the removing of all barriers between us and other people. The barriers are all gone. And that is one reason why it is called the apamana citta. There's a sense of boundlessness about it. No barriers. Nothing which anymore, you don't have anymore this idea of me and you, enemy and friend. Everybody is kind of just together in the same thing. You're friendly with everyone. All the barriers have been broken down. And this is one of the reasons why these states of mind, if you develop the Brahma Viharas, or even if you just develop samadhi to the level of jhana, this is why these things are so incredibly powerful, because you feel that you have broken down the barriers between you and others. all sense of conflict, all sense of violence, all sense of disagreement with other people, all that has completely gone. This is why these things are states of universal love, right? Metta. Universal love, universal compassion, universal friendliness to everybody. Because those barriers are all gone. And you can see why people find these states so incredibly powerful. You've found something which is really getting close to the meaning of life itself. Wow, the whole world, the whole universe is unified because there are no barriers anymore. There's complete friendliness, complete compassion, complete love to all beings everywhere. All the limits have been taken away here. So you can understand when people get to those things, why they think this itself is the meaning of life. You found kind of the answer to the problems of the universe. So very, very powerful states that are so meaningful when you actually get there. Our attachment to sensuality is one of the things then, quite clearly from this, that stops us from having that universal friendliness, universal kindness to all beings. This is one of the problems, because sensuality, by its very nature, creates barriers. It creates attractive, unattractive. It creates all these things that stops us from being able to access these states of mind. So that is a very good reason for you to abandon a little bit of sensuality and move towards these remarkable states that are really there, available for everyone if one practices in the right way. So you have a limited mind, right, because of that. And you do not understand, as it actually is, the deliverance of mind and the deliverance by wisdom, wherein those bad, unwholesome qualities cease without remainder. You have never had an experience of samadhi before. This is the deliverance of mind, right? Chetta vimokha, chetta vimutti, deliverance of mind. You've never had that experience before, and because you don't know that experience, you are attached to the sensual realm. The more samadhi experience you have, the more you understand the limitations of the sensual realm, and the less you are carried away by likes and dislikes in that realm. And ultimately you have the deliverance by wisdom, panya vimutti, and of course that is the highest insight when you understand these things fully and you abandon them completely and craving has completely ended. Neither of these do you have, and because of that you have no perspective, you have no understanding, you have no ability to see these things for what they actually are, you have no higher vantage point from which to stand and look down upon sensuality and understand that world of sensuality. So because you haven't got that, you are trapped, you are blind, you are ignorant. You're standing at the beginning of dependent arising with ignorance. And you're creating all the sankharas which entrap you in samsara, just keeping on going and going and going. So those bad, unwholesome qualities, dhammas, right? States, it has here. States is like the idea from the Abhidhamma that these are discrete qualities. These are real kind of things, right? I think qualities is probably a better translation here. Evil, I don't like the word evil. Bad, unwholesome qualities, all of that cease. You don't have no idea where that is. So, engaged as he is in favoring and opposing, right? This is what favoring and opposing is all about. Whatever feeling he feels, whether pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, he delights in that feeling, welcomes it, and remains holding to it. As he does so, delight arises in him. Now delight in feeling is clinging here. And then the rest of dependent arising happens as a consequence of that. So here again we have a bit more of the same, right? We can see all the states, all the stages of dependent arising are described here. The favoring and opposing, this has to do with upadana already, you know, craving, giving rise to you, choosing objects in the world, choosing what you like, taking certain things up, leaving other things aside. So this is already moving into the area of upadana here. And whatever you feel, you delight in that, you delight in the things that you have taken up, right? In the things you own, the things that you are attached to, etc. You delight in those things. One of the slightly strange things here, it says that whatever feelings he feels, right, whether pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, he delights in that feeling. So what this seems to be saying is that regardless of the type of feeling you have, you delight in them, which is kind of strange. Usually we would say that you delight in pleasant feelings and you are averse to unpleasant feelings. So I am not sure why this is the case. I can only speculate perhaps a little bit. One possibility is that maybe the text was originally different. That's always possible. There are always tiny little corruptions coming into the text. That is one possibility. Or perhaps this is actually the way it has always been. And so what does it mean then? If this is the real thing, what does it mean to delight in a painful feeling here? And of course, the reason why we do that is that because the craving for existence is so strong in us, we want to exist, right? This is the majority of people. And sometimes, even though you have to exist in a painful existence, you prefer to exist in a painful existence rather than not exist at all. And this is why sometimes we welcome the painful feeling, right? It's better than annihilation. The last thing you want to do is to be annihilated. So even if you have to be reborn in the animal realm, even if you have to go to a hell realm, right? You'd rather do that than to be annihilated, to come to an end, and to have your dear sense of self. It all comes back to the sense of self. Sense of self is so dear to us, it is so close to us, that we would rather exist with pain than not exist at all. And this could be the message that is here. I'm not entirely sure. It is just my guess, really. Yes, because basically we identify with those unpleasant feelings. We can use them as a source of identity. And because the source of identity is so important, this also gains meaning from that. Anyway, whatever the answer is, he delights in it, he welcomes it, and all of this delighting in things that you have taken up, all of this is clinging, right? This is upadana, attachment, owning things, picking things up, grasping hold of things, and then the rest of dependent arising happens as a consequence. So with clinging as condition, there is bhava. You live in that state. You live in that world. Your mind is obsessed by all these attachments and things that you're holding on to. And then you get reborn in a state accordingly. With being or existence as condition, there is birth. With birth as condition, there is old age and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering here. So there you are. That is a practical example, still not perhaps 100% practical. There's still quite a bit of theory there, but you're starting to get closer to understand what is happening here. So now you can apply all of this to your own life. You can see how this actually works out. You can feel in your mind how you can see that when you crave, you can see how it's always based on feeling. You can see how you attach to things as a consequence of craving. Everybody attaches to things, right? Monastics often attach to views. You see monastics arguing with each other, right? This is the right interpretation. No, that one is. And of course, a little bit of discussion is important, but sometimes it goes too far and it gives rise to defilements rather than give rise to any kind of serious movement forward on the path. And then, of course, you live, the bhava comes, you live, and then this attachment to view sometimes itself can be enough to give rise to rebirth as a consequence. So there you are. And now we have just passed the hour, I think. So we have now looked at dependent arising. We are roughly halfway through the retreats. That's what I said. Halfway through, we will finish dependent arising, and then we will move on to things that have a little bit more practical or are more direct. This is also practical. I don't think this is impractical, what we have been doing, but now we're going to focus more directly on practical issues, how to deal with the mind and all of these kind of things. And that we will start that this afternoon at 3:00. So we'll see you then again here.